Have you ever tried to find models of spiritual giants to imitate? Do you find them hard to find? I do. I found them to be rare. I found them to be far apart. Since we are studying the spiritual journey of faith, whom do you know who are giants of faith? Everyone we know are flawed. Everyone we know are imperfect. Some more, some less. Who do we know who is perfect? No one. No one, that is, except Jesus. Who then can be our model? As we journey through this long, long distance, I've come to this conclusion. Since there's no one perfect, then the only thing we can do is, what you see in others that you like, go and do the same. And what you see in others that you don't like, go and do the opposite. That is so true in the life of Abraham, a giant of faith. But in Genesis 12, he didn't seem to be such worthy of being a model of faith, did he? He couldn't stand the pressure of famine in Canaan. So he tried to find refuge for himself in Egypt. And when he got to Egypt, he couldn't stand the pressure of losing his life because of his wife. So he tried to save his own skin by sacrificing his wife. He was not much of a model of faith in Genesis 12 until he come back to the land that God has called him, until he come back to the land that God has promised him. And whenever he lived with his eyes upward to God and not sideways to the world, he lived in faith and he was exemplary. And whenever he lived building altars and seeking fellowship with God, he lived in faith and he was exemplary. And we see his giant footprints in Genesis 13 and Genesis 14. We continue in the narratives of Genesis 14. He fought a great battle against all odds. As soon as he heard the news that his nephew Lot was taken captive, he got up from his easy chair. He put away his lemonade. He strapped on his weapons. He got on his camel. He rallied his troops and he rallied his allies. And he fought a great, great battle against Kedorlaomer and his three other allies. And at the end of verse 16, we think to ourselves, Abram had just fought the greatest battles of his life and he won. That's what we thought to ourselves. Is that right? Has Abram fought the greatest battle of his life and he won? On the surface, it seems to be so. But as we continue from verses 17 to 24, we realize that the greatest battle was still ahead of him. The victory Abram won so far up to verse 16 was against sleeping enemies. They were drunk with wine. But the next battle for Abram was far more daunting. The next battle Abram had to fight was against himself, against the temptation of embracing the world, against the temptation of pride, against the temptation of possessions. The most vulnerable time for Abram was not the moment he crossed sword with Kedorlaomer. The most vulnerable time for Abram was he had finished off Kedorlaomer. And now Abram is returning from his victory. He's leading a long column of redeemed captives. And behind them, we're trailing a long, long distance behind, were all kinds of livestock, all kinds of spoils, all kinds of valuables. Chapter 14, verse 16 is when Abram, the most vulnerable. It's always the case. It was a case with giants like Joshua. The most vulnerable time for Joshua was not Joshua chapter 6, when he had to conquer Jericho. The most vulnerable time for Joshua was chapter 7 of the book of Joshua, after the fall of Jericho, after the most improbable victory. That is when Achan committed his sin and the Israelites suffered a great loss at Ai. God's people are always the most vulnerable to temptation after great spiritual victories. Elijah reminds us the same truth. The most vulnerable time for Elijah was not 1 Kings chapter 18. 1 Kings chapter 18, that's when he did battle with 850 false prophets and he won. That was not the most vulnerable time for him. The most vulnerable time for Elijah was the next chapter, 1 Kings chapter 19. After his greatest victory on Mount Carmel, Elijah lost his nerve and he ran for his life because he was afraid of Jezebel. What a great demonstrations of faith and power in the 18th chapter of 1 Kings. And what a demonstration of failure in chapter 19 of 1 Kings. It's the same for all of us. Then and now, the journey of faith is never ever without battles. It is always one battle after another. Whether we run from victory to victory or we run from defeat to another defeat will depend on what we do after each battle. What Abram had to fight after defeating Chedorlaomer was against three temptations. Verses 17 to 24 tells us that he is up against a temptation of embracing both God and the world. And then he was up against a temptation of pride. And then finally, he was up against the temptation of material possessions. And if Abram had failed to exercise spiritual vigilance, he would have failed in all three of those temptations. Look at the first one. The temptation to embrace God and the world at the same time. Come to us in verses 17 to 18. Let's read it one more time, please. We have a few more minutes today. Verses 17 and 18. Shall we together, please? Together. After Abram returned from defeating Chedorlaomer and the king's ally with him, the king of Sodom came out to meet him in the valley of Shaveh. That is the king's valley. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High. We stop there. What do we have here? We have two persons meeting Abram when he returned after the victory. We have king of Sodom and we have Melchizedek. Now the NIV gives us the impression that these two kings did not meet Abram at the same time. The NIV tells us that the king of Sodom met Abram first. And what is the next word? Then Melchizedek showed up. But when we check with the Hebrew text, the word then should really be translated as and. There's a conjunction that means and. The NASB, I don't know if you're reading the NASB. The NASB has a more accurate translation. The king of Sodom came to meet Abram. And Melchizedek came also at the same time to meet Abram. Now, two men in front of Abram, both in their regal, colorful regalia, both are distinguished looking, and they form a very impressive welcoming committee. Now, if you were Abram, what would you do? Both of them are coming to you at you at the same time. You most probably would have considered them, oh, they come together. They must be two of the same. You most probably would have thought they are two of the same. And Abram had all the reason to think that they are two of the same. There are no indication that Abram knew the king of Sodom, and there's no indication that Abram knew Melchizedek before. Besides, who was Melchizedek? You know, even today we really don't know who he was for sure. Okay, we know what function God made him to do, but who was he? We really don't know, honestly. This is the first time in written history that this name, Melchizedek, was mentioned. And the next time Melchizedek is mentioned in the Bible will be 1,000 years later. And he will be mentioned in Psalm 110. And between Genesis and Psalm, and between Abram and Psalm 110, there's a difference of 1,000 years. Psalm 110 is a messianic psalm and that prophesies the coming Messiah will be a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. What priest order of Melchizedek is that? Jews and we only know for sure that there is the order of Aaron, the Levitical order. order of Melchizedek? There's no reference of that. And the next time after Psalm 110, when Melchizedek's name is mentioned in the Bible, will be another 1,000 years later. In the 7th chapter of Hebrew, the writer of Hebrew mentioned him in chapter 7 to illustrate the superiority of Jesus' priesthood over the priesthood of Aaron, and therefore over the old system of law. Now, why was Jesus' priesthood superior according to Hebrew chapter 7? Because Jesus' priesthood is according to the order of Melchizedek. That's all we know about this person, Melchizedek. We know his name means King of Righteousness. It can also translate to means my king is righteousness. We know he's a king of Salem. The word Salem is short for Jerusalem, which means he was a king of peace. We know he is called priest of God Most High. But where did he come from? God does not tell us. Where did he go? God does not tell us. God only tells us that he has no beginning of days. In other words, he has no date of birth. Hebrews 7 tells us that there was no end of life. That means there was no date of death. Who was his father? God does not say. Who was his mother? God does not say. So this mystery in the riddle tied up. There's no indication, more information than we know. And yet at the same time, standing next to him, welcoming Abram, was this king of Sodom. In other words, here is the king of righteousness, standing next to the dark lord of evil. Why should Abram embrace one and turn away from the other? If I were him, I would take my hands out and shake the hand, both of their hands. Thanks for coming out. Why should Abram accept fellowship from one and turn away from the other? Why can't Abram embrace them both? Why can't Abram accept fellowship from both? That was the first temptation Abram faced at the height of his triumph. He was tempted to put aside his spiritual commitment to God and embrace the world at the same time. In our journey of faith, we will face the same temptation all the time. Some of our children are coming back home now from college, and they are with us. Ask them if they had to face temptation this past year. Ask them if they had to face the same temptation of embracing God and embracing the world at the same time. I'm sure they will tell you again and again they were tempted to embrace both God and the world at the same time. And we who are out of school, we are not in school anymore, we are in the workplace now. Don't we also face the same temptation again and again? Don't we have to answer the same question? Why can I embrace, why can I accept both God and the world? Abram answered that question for us. He said we cannot, and he did not. If Abram had embraced the king of Sodom, he would be just like his nephew Lot. He would have sold his tents, and he would have moved into a permanent address in Sodom. If Abram had done that, he would have become someone in need of a rescue instead of being a rescuer. If Abram had done that, he would have become someone in need of intercession instead of being an intercessor. Abram refused to shake the hands of the king of Sodom. He refused to embrace the world and all the glitter and all the beautiful attraction this world has to offer. See, the victory Abram won at this juncture was far greater than the victory he won over Laodikedoma. The second victory Abram won was the temptation over pride. Now imagine for a moment you were Abram. How would you see yourself? How would you see your victory? Most likely, you would think to yourself, I have earned the bragging rights. Most likely, you know, we would probably think to ourselves, we were such great strategists. I was such great tactician. I was the bold, I was so daring, I was so decisive, I worked so hard, I was so superior. No one will dare messing with me now. It's so natural for us to think like that, to see ourselves like that. It's so natural for us to act like that and behave like that. When was the last time you won some recognition? When was the last time you won some award? In school or at work, in your eyes, in the eyes of your peers, in the eyes of your superior, you won something. Do you remember that? You remember to whom you gave credit? You were promoted. You enjoy some kind of success. Did that bring you a sense of superiority? Or did that bring you a sense of inferiority? Of course, you say, wow, that gave me a sense, a great sense of superiority. But not Abram. This is his victory. Instead of harboring a sense of superiority, he had a sense of inferiority. And that's what verses 18 to 20 tells us. That the great victory he won, instead of bringing him a sense that he was superior, it brought him a sense of inferiority. It gave him a sense of humility. Melchizedek may have come from nowhere and gone to nowhere, at least nowhere that we can comprehend. But this we can understand. God has his purpose of bringing this mystery man into the life of Abram. And God has his purpose of bringing this mystery man into our spiritual awareness too. The most helpful and best way to understand this Melchizedek is that he is an Old Testament type of Christ. Now, what is a type? An Old Testament type means a preview of something that is to come. A type means a foreshadowing of someone that is to come in the New Testament. And for Melchizedek, he's a type of Christ. He's not a father, he's not having a mother, typifies Christ, whose birth was not natural result of human conception. His name Melchizedek, which means King of Righteousness, typifies Christ, who is a king of righteous kingdom of God. Melchizedek is a king of Salem, typifies Christ, who is a prince of peace. Melchizedek, having no beginning of days and no end of life, typifies Christ's eternity. Christ having no point of beginning and Christ having no point of end. Melchizedek being king of Salem and at the same time being priest of God Most High, typify Christ being the King of Kings and the High Priest on our behalf, ministering on our behalf in the presence of God. That is what makes Jesus' priesthood superior to the Aaronic, to the Levitical priesthood. Do you remember in Aaronic priesthood, Levitical priesthood, the system of Mosaic law, no one can be priest and king at the same time. Priests can only come from the line of Aaron. Priests can only come from the line of Levi. Saul, where was Saul from? Whose family was Saul from? Saul was not from Aaron. Saul was not from the tribe of Levi. Saul was from the tribe of Benjamin. And that is why the sin he committed in the 1 Samuel was so great. Saul was waiting for Samuel at Gilgal. And Samuel was late in coming. And Saul couldn't wait any longer. This is 1 Samuel chapter 13. Because his fighting man of Israel was deserting him. So Saul took it upon himself to offer up the burnt offering. And now Samuel showed up. And then Samuel showed Saul his displeasure. See, offering, the burnt offering, was a sacred duty that only a Levitical priest can perform. Kings of Israel comes from either Benjamin, from Saul, or from David's line, which is Judah, never from Levi. And that's why, according to Mosaic law, a king and a priest can never be the same person. But here is Melchizedek. Neither a Levite, nor a Benjamin, nor a Judah, nor from Judah. He is foreshadowing the kingship and priesthood of Christ Jesus. And how Abram recognized that God does not tell us. But what God does tell us is this. Abram humbled himself before God and acknowledged that the battle he fought and the victory he won really belongs to the Lord and not to him. How do we know that? We know that because of two things Abram did. First of all, he accepted the bread and wine Melchizedek offered him. The Bible does not specifically say Abram accepted the bread and wine, but the fact that Abram offered Melchizedek an offering of tithe showed that he accepted the bread and wine. Now, what does that mean, giving Abram bread and wine mean? If you have a NIV study Bible, the study book, we say that in no way relate to the New Testament ordinance union. I disagree with that. I don't believe that is true. I believe it does. Now, why did Melchizedek offer Abram dates and goat milk? That would have been just as common and available as bread and wine. Why not a roasted lamb? Why not camel milk? Both are expression of hospitality, but Melchizedek specifically offered bread and wine. Bread expresses sustenance of life, and wine expresses the joy of life. And that is what Christ offers us. If we would humble ourselves before him, and if we would express our need of having Christ in our lives, Christ offers us the bread of life, and Christ offers us the joy of life. If we accept Melchizedek as a type of Christ, then what Melchizedek did was also a type of what Christ did. So by accepting what Melchizedek offered, Abram is showing his dependency on this superior being. Great victory won him greater humility than pride. The second thing that Abram did is in verse 19. Verse 19 tells us Melchizedek blessed Abram. And he blessed Abram, saying, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who delivered your enemies into your hand." You see, in ancient Near East culture, it is all superior blesses the inferior. The Bible does not tell us specifically Abram accepted the blessing, but his offering of tithe shows to us that he accepted that blessing. Abram is saying to Melchizedek, "You are my superior. I am your inferior." There's a third thing that Abram did. He gave Melchizedek a tenth of all that he had. It is always the inferior who bring offering, who give offering to the superior. And Abram is acknowledging who is superior here and who is inferior here. It takes a great victor to humble himself and acknowledge his great improbable victory was not a result of his prowess, but the result of God's mighty hand and perfect will. Abram acknowledged the battle and the victory belonged to the Lord. Few travelers on this journey of faith ever overcome these temptations of pride consistently. It is far more natural and far more easier to have our head all blown up because of our successes and because of our achievements. Abram is a worthy model for us to imitate in this area because of his victory over the temptation of pride. There's a third temptation, the temptation over material possession. You ever ask yourself this question? Can we ever possess enough? Can we ever have enough or too much possessions? I remember in the early days when I first come to this country, when we were renting a little apartment in Philadelphia, we dreamed of owning maybe a little condo. At that time, there was no condo yet. It was too early, 40-some years ago. We dreamed of at least, in Philadelphia, we call them row houses. Long row, sharing the wall. We finally, after we did not get a row house, we got a twin house. After we own our own twin house, we dream of owning a single family house with a yard and central air and central heat. When we own our own single family homes with a house, now we dream of owning a second vacation home next to a lake. Are you like that? I'm not ridiculing you. I'm talking about myself because I confess I'm like that. When I first come to this country, everywhere I go, everywhere I need to go, I walk. The first year, When I first came, my parents bought me a pair of new shoes, and after 1 year, I had a hole this big in that shoe because I was walking everywhere. And at the time, I remember I dreamed of having a bike. When I had a bike, I dreamed about owning a car. And now I've had a car, I dream of owning an RV. And after I have an RV, I dream of owning a convertible. I'm not really thinking with anybody here because I'm talking about myself. Can we ever possess enough? Can we ever possess too many, too much? See, the temptation of possessions is what we have to face when we journey on this journey of faith. And that's what Abram was facing too. Abram was already fabulously rich. But can he ever own enough? He came back from this great victory. He brought back safely all the captives. But don't forget all the spoils, all the livestock, all the precious metals, all the gold and all the silver, and all the finest of cloth. Yes, he gave 1/10 to Melchizedek, but what about the rest? What about the 90%? That's exactly what the king of Sodom offered him. Verse 21, the king of Sodom said to Abram, give me the people and keep the goods for yourself. Everything else you can keep. That's a lot of wealth. Why not? It's the most reasonable offering. To the victor goes the spoil. The king of Sodom did nothing to earn the right to keep the spoil. After all, he was a loser, remember? He had to run up the hills to hide for his life. After all, it was Abram who had the right to keep it all. Why is there a limit of wealth? You ever think to yourself, why should I have a limit of my wealth? But to Abram, he would have nothing to do with keeping the spoil. Abram had good reasons. Number one, he had already raised his hand to God and taken a vow. He would accept nothing belonging to this king of Sodom, because his hand will keep nothing from such a place of evil. Because he had made his commitment to God that he would not accept blessing from God and at the same time accept blessing from this evil world. To Abram, the blessing from evil has no attraction to him. That's another reason why Abram would not keep anything. Because to him, the honor of God is worth far more than his own honor. Because the honor of God is worth far more than his own honor. You know, having the title richest man in the world impressed a lot of people, but it did not impress Abram. I imagine accepting the 90% of the spoil would easily make him the richest man of the world at that time. Anybody ever read Fortune 500, the magazine? Or Forbes? I think every year they come up with an article, they come up with a list of 100 wealthiest men in the world or 100 wealthiest women in the world. I think they do. They have a list, right? Now, when I was in China a few times, recently, I went to the bookstore. You know what's the biggest seller in Chinese bookstore? It's a biography. It's a story about all those wealthy Chinese who became so filthily, fabulously rich in the last 10, 20 years. Big pile of these books about all those that make it big time. Don't those lists impress you? I mean, doesn't that inspire you to dream that one day I will be on that list? Now, wouldn't that be the great honor? One day, there will be a book about me in all the bookstores in China. But to Abram, being on such a list impressed him none, because he was far more concerned with God's honor than with his own. Abram wanted only to credit his success and his wealth to God and to no one else, because in verse 33, he said to the king of Sodom, so that you will never be able to say, I made Abram rich. Because Abram wanted God to enjoy the exclusive honor of being the one who had blessed him with all that he has. Very few men who traveled on this journey of faith have won victory in this area consistently. Because honestly, how do we answer this question? Can we ever own enough? can we ever possess enough? When we look at all our prized possessions, whether it is those luxury items or status symbols or our bragging rights, can we genuinely look at them and confess, not my credit, not my skills, not my hard work, but God and God alone gave them to me? Very few travelers on this journey of faith can say that honestly and consistently. But Abram did. See, the good we see in him, we go and do likewise. He overcame the temptation of embracing both God and the world at the same time. He overcame the temptation of pride. He overcame the temptation of never owning enough. These are battles we fight against ourselves. And victories in them are greater victories of faith. Here is where Abram is worthy to be followed. We go and do likewise. Let's all stand together with a response hymn that we can sing together.